Hello and welcome to today's episode of the Daily Friend Show. I'm Herman Pretorius, filling in for Nick Lorimer, who will hopefully be joining us shortly when he is fully recovered. Our best to Nick. But today I am joined so that you are not just saddled with me. I'm joined by the estimable Michael Morris, chief co-editor of the Daily Friend, longtime liberal, and of course, the person at the IRR who makes us all seem that we can actually string a few sentences in a row to make a convincing point. I'm not going to allow you to interrupt me and minimize my intro of praise. Michael, let's get cracking into the first story. Now, this is quite interesting. United States bill to sanction South Africa moves forward from Business Tech, and quite a few media houses reported on this particular development. And the background of this is that Congressman Jackson of Texas has introduced a bill into to Congress, and it has passed its first committee stage, that would in effect give review to the South Africa, United States of America relationship in terms of trade, geopolitical interests. But perhaps the juiciest morsel of this proposed piece of legislation is that it allows for sanctions, not necessarily against South Africa as a country, sort of if we think about the apartheid era sanctions that were economic, industrial, and sectoral. These will be targeted perhaps at specific individuals within government and within the ANC. The promotion of this bill and its passage through the committee, the House committee addressing these issues, is quite interesting, because it takes this position that South Africa has taken the side of Hamas, that South Africa has taken the side of the communists against America, against free market interests, capitalist interests. And that is, I think, all in all, not an unfair judgment, as long as you qualify it, that these positions have been taken by the government of South Africa. When it comes to the issues of policy and approval of Israel or the Palestinian cause or America, South Africans on the ground offer a much more colorful and patchwork opinion landscape. But the government in and of itself, representing South Africa on the international stage, very much earning to my mind at least, this sort of stern rebuke or process of rebuke from America. Before I come to you, Michael, briefly, I think it's important perhaps to put on the table that this isn't a Trump-era development. This goes back to the Biden term and to the first Trump term, where South Africa has increasingly grown to become a bit of an irritant to American interests. We can remember that it was Reuben Brigidy, the American ambassador to South Africa, a Biden appointee, therefore a Democrat appointee, that sort of took issue with the Lady R scandal. And so we should be careful, and I think the South African government and commentators should be careful not to see this as, this is another development in Trump's relationship with South Africa. Number one, this is coming from Congress, not the White House. And number two, the itch of South Africa that the Americans have started scratching predates Trump's second term. Michael, what do you make of all this? What should South Africans make of the implications of, you know, the Congress of America taking this level of interest in what's going on in South Africa?
I think it's kind of a combination of gratitude almost and perplexity and you know, frustration. Gratitude in the sense that, you know, somebody is flagging what I think most ordinary South Africans really do feel is true, that as a people, as a society, we are renowned for being open to the world and being willing to be friendly, even with societies or cultures that are, you know, kind of far removed on the face of things from our realities. And I think we have a reputation for being, you know, an openness and being friendly, being pragmatic also, that we recognize in all these things who our real friends and allies are, who we feel at home with. We feel at home with societies that are more open, that are not repressive, generally speaking, as ordinary South Africans. And yet, as you rightly point out and make this distinction between the you know, bulk of society, ordinary people going about their lives, and on the other hand, we have the policymakers, the people who are running the government, who have displayed, as you also point out, over a long period, not simply the short term of this Trump administration, even the previous one, a longer period than that, displayed the sort of stubborn resistance to the simple acknowledgement of who our real allies and friends are and why. There's a reason why we have good friends in the United States and in Europe and elsewhere, because these are people who actually trade with us. These are people we benefit from. These are people whose relationships are meaningful to us as an entire society, from the corporates who you know, doing a business that runs into the billions, right the way down to very ordinary people who are getting goods and services from these kinds of economies, open economies that are willing to trade and so on. And it's just a crying shame that we have time and again turned a blind eye to these very pragmatic, very sensible assessments of where we stand in the world and why, and are pursuing, you know, wildly inappropriate ideological positions that are actually harmful. And that is a great shame. So, yeah.
And I think particularly if you look at sort of the Clinton presidency and the Mandela presidency and how eager Clinton was to have Mandela's approval, it was a different South Africa. It was a different ANC. There was a moral high ground there that has just been chipped away by decades of ANC failure. It doesn't strike me that, you know, anything other really fundamentally changed, other than that we went from being a story that had upward potential and hope to a story of that hope being squandered, that dream sort of being deferred. And perhaps one could even trace the hairline cracks in the relationship now widening into chasms to the fallout of the Iraq War 20 years ago, where Mandela and Mbeki really became quite critical of the US. The US seemed to maintain their soft power, you know, Hollywood, music industry, the Grammys, the Oscars. But over the last 20 years, that initial break of the Iraq War, America not being seen as a pragmatic partner, but as sort of a sinister Western imperialist force, I think we look back on a slumber of that, then with the Iraq War triggering that and leading us to where we are today. But as you say, there's some gratitude in this, because South Africans, if we are to look at the polling by the Social Research Foundation of the last year or so, on the issue of targeted sanctions against specific ANC leaders, we see almost a 50-50 split in favor and opposed. So it's not, I think, a slam dunk that this would be popular or unpopular in South Africa. But if it is significant enough pressure to show the ANC that, you know, actions have consequences, even if they are late in coming, that we are seeing some chickens coming home with the intention of roosting. So definitely something to keep an eye on. Then moving on to our second story, which also perhaps resembles the slow change of things rather than dramatic turnarounds and Berlin walls falling all over the place. We have reporting by Business Live saying GNU secures first round approval for appropriation bill amid internal fault lines. Now, for brief context, the national budget consists of several parts. with the appropriation bill being the final thing that should go through Parliament for the budget to be signed off, to be practicable, to be operational. And the appropriation bill passed today is the final part of that now months-long process. And there had been simmering doubt about the appropriation bill because of the DA's ultimatum a few weeks ago to President Ramaphosa after the firing of Andrew Whitfield as Deputy Minister of Trade and Industry, saying, you know, fire corruption-implicated ministers or we will not, be here for the long term, was a paraphrase. But the DA decided that they would not vote for the parts of the departmental budget parts of the appropriation bill that would, if they had stuck to that, would have sunk this bill's passage, at least from a GNU perspective, and that would have led quite likely to Ramaphosa acting against all GNU DA ministers and deputy ministers, signaling the exit from the DA for the DA from the GNU. That fate has now been avoided by the DA saying, we take the win of getting rid of Minister for Higher Education and Training, Minister Nkabane, for implications and setters and misleading the parliament about it. But the bill now being passed, what you said to me is something interesting, why this story caught your eye. In the article, they quote Andrew Bateman of the DA saying, we don't need a national dialogue. We need more dialogue between the ANC and the DA. And Tara Ruiz, parliamentary correspondent, writes, underscoring the centrality of those two parties. Why did that stand out for you in this GNU sort of accomplishment? Let's not call it a victory or a success.
I'm going to quote you back to yourself now. We in our pre-show chat, you were talking about, you know, the importance of focusing on the fairly kind of prosaic government processes and making those work. Our colleague Maurice Ruett had raised this as well, saying, you know, what we're seeing here is the GNU actually working. But there was a phrase you used, it's not flashy, it's not sexy, or even necessarily appealing. But it is central to how this coalition has worked. And having written a book about the election that delivered the present circumstances, you have a special insight into these dynamics. But I think what Andrew Bateman says there is very striking. Just to repeat it, we don't need a national dialogue. We need more dialogue between the ANC and the DA. These are the, as Tara Ruiz pointed out, the central parties. The parties are central to the functioning and the survival of the GNU. That is the conversation that is important and important to focus on. I think you know, it's very significant that Nkabane is the name that we remember now. This is what the DA had insisted on, and the DA is able now to continue in the process in this way. The key thing being that really, from the public point of view, and I often think the public doesn't slavishly follow the ins and outs of the politics and who's who and what's going on, but they do have a quite an acute sense of whether people are pulling their weight, whether people are doing what they promised to do. Broadly speaking, I think most voters, most of the public has quite a pragmatic view of that. They don't expect people to be saints. They don't expect people to be able to stick to every little detail of everything that they have promised, but they have a sense of, are they sticking basically to their word? Are they serving us? And this is what these two parties really promised to do last year, after that extraordinary election that you wrote your book about. And this is really, you know, how are we going to get a sense of this? And it's all these little things that are important in underlining the reason why coalition politics is a plausible kind of deliverable, and it is going to restore a measure of faith in politics, in voting. People are, you know, they can see it as very visible, but they sense it, I think, also in their lives, in their service delivery. I was looking at an interesting piece just the other day on the Rational Standard about Leon Schreiber and how, you know, he's quietly working away with coalface reforms, little things that are broken that he can fix, that are being fixed, and so on. I think that's very, very important in the sense of serving a national interest, emboldening the idea and people's trust, emboldening the trust, public trust in the political process, in voting, and in a government that works. And I think this is why Andrew Bateman is quite correct. You know, we can talk until the cows come home. That's not really what matters. What matters is the conversation between the most important parties running the show. Yeah,
I fully agree. And what I think is people should remember here is that a government stands or falls in the Westminster tradition on the ability to do at least two things. In the strict Westminster system, you add a third, but us being a variant of the Westminster system, you only really have two, and that is, can you elect an executive and keep that executive in office, and can you pass a budget? If a government can do those two things, it can call itself a government. It can actually govern. It cannot always legislate, but there's a difference between legislating and governing, because governing is to give effect to the laws on the statute book as is. So if you can elect an executive, as they did last year with President Ramaphosa, and you can pass a budget, as now seems to be close to the final case here after months, then number one, you can call yourself a government. And the second point is, if we look towards this government, what do we see? Do we see great reformist zeal? No. Do we see U-turns from pro-poverty to pro-growth policy en masse? No. But do we see a government that has to compromise and find a way forward dealing with what the voter handed them to pass a budget and appoint a cabinet? Most definitely. So in that sense, what we're seeing play out here is political parties, whether we like them or not, or approve of them or not, or the way they do this, it's them trying to cope with the outcome that the voter handed them a year ago. And on that front, I'm quite pleased to see that we have a painful budget process. It shouldn't be easy, because an easy budget process is not a contested budget process. And an uncontested budget process is not a GNU. It's not a coalition. It's not a multi-party representative process. So we might look at this and some people might feel embarrassed and squirm and say, oh, you know, how amateurish. But I just think, you know, this is democracy, and freedom is sometimes messy. And we're seeing the consequences of that now. With some signs of change. Is it amazing change? No. Is it welcome change? I think so. It's movement in the right direction. I can't remember an ANC minister being fired for alleged wrongdoing, and we now do see that. Am I going to mark it in my diary as the date South Africa was saved and started its great trajectory towards freedom and prosperity? No. But if you compare what's happening now to what was happening in the previous government period, when it was just the ANC calling the shots, we are seeing something different, and it's awkward, but it is democracy in the end. And then our last story before we wrap up for today is also one you drew our attention to, Michael. It's former Chief Justice Zondo saying, "My faith in the Hawks is not the same. Zondo says Scorpions were more effective," reports News 24. Now, Michael, as we mentioned in the pre-show chat, the controversy of the Scorpions and the Hawks slightly predate my time at the IRR, my time being plugged into this professionally. I was sort of moderately, amateurishly, and childishly curious at the time. But could you perhaps explain to us the historical context, roughly 20 years ago? What was it that made the Scorpions the sort of hot button topic that 15 years after it's been canned, we're still pining for it as a country?
One of the deficits of being of an age to have be able to say that one has lived through that period is that, of course, one's memory may not serve one particularly well. So in the detail, we'd spend a long time talking about the detail, but in this very simple form, the scorpions were demonstrating their effectiveness. It was quite evident to the ANC government that they had on their hands an institution that was serving a public interest, not a party one, and it was very, very discomforting. There were all kinds of things going wrong within the ruling party. I often think back, I was then a journalist covering not only politics, but all sorts of other things, but in the 90s, towards the end of the 90s, the arms deal, you suddenly had this anxiety rising in society and thinking people that the ANC was becoming complacent and shameless about missteps and about corruption that was evident but not being dealt with properly. And the one exception was the Scorpions. The Scorpions really, even the name is a wonderful name for a corruption-busting outfit. There was a sense that this was it could deliver a really toxic jab to people who or institutions that deserved wrongdoing, and that was really the setting in which the ruling party, now compromised, conscious of the scale of corruption that was growing, made the fatal mistake of thinking that by removing the investigative instrument that ought at that point to have been allowed to continue its work and to root it out or to confront it very vigorously. They disabled that process and delivered, unfortunately, to the country the chronic phase of state capture and the terrific loss of not merely of rands running to the trillions. But of course, the impact chiefly on the poor. It was robbing the society of resources that it desperately needed. And we still now are sitting with the consequences of that. So very broadly speaking, there's a great deal of detail. I do remember some of it, but we'd get lost in the weeds, I think, if we started going into the detail. But essentially, it was it was showing itself to be effective. It had the powers. It had this kind of independent-mindedness. And the vigor to tackle wrongdoing, and that was seen as a danger by important forces within the ruling party, which then decided to disband them, and that was a great shame. So now you have important people like former Justice Raymond Zondo, former Chief Justice Raymond Zondo, and of course the author of the Zondo Report on state capture, saying these very, very important things, very strongly worded statements he's made. I think just today, if I'm not mistaken, he was speaking at the South African Council of Churches anti-corruption conference in Johannesburg, and how very important for our society to have people like that who are prepared to say what they really think.
Yeah. And I'm so glad you mentioned the arms deal, because as human beings, I do think we sort of tend to suffer from what should one call it? Episodic temporal chauvinism, in the sense that you look at the episode you're in and you assume 'twas ever thus. The intensity of the moment is so defining that it's sometimes difficult not to look at the events of what happened at a time, but to try and understand what the feeling and the sentiment and the public mind, the sort of vibes were around the time. So it's very interesting that you mentioned that there was this disquiet that was brewing from the arms deal onwards. And what I think so vitally important about mentioning the arms deal when we talk about the scorpions and the hawks is that we've seen a very brave public rep stunt narrative develop over the last few years, that state capture was somehow a unique, it came out of nowhere, was a bolt of the blue. Before Polokwane, it didn't exist. Then Zuma came along, then it existed. And now we're sort of dealing with the stuttering consequences. Where in fact, state capture could be traced back to the arms deal and the banishment of the scorpions. And the scorpions might have died their final death under Zuma, but it didn't start then. Mm-hmm. It was this this disquiet and this probably this ANC arrogance that said, we're a 70% party. We've gone from a 60% party to a 70% party. We can do what we please. And now they're a 40% party or a 30% party, if you look at our polling. And the picture seems to have changed. Now we have former Chief Justice being able to say, you know, that is a disquieting feature. And perhaps from a policy point of view, it's useful for listeners perhaps to appreciate the key difference between the scorpions being this effective sting unit and the hawks is that the scorpions were an entity of the national prosecuting authority. They weren't answerable to a politician. They were answerable to the director of public prosecutions, where the hawks are a creature of the South African police and therefore answerable to the Minister of Police. So considerably less stingy and more feathery. So perhaps the names are appropriate. But to connect it sort of to the current moment and perhaps to what the GNU could mean for South Africa as we bring today's episode to a close, is the interesting thing that we read a few days ago in the Daily Maverick by Advocate Glynis Breytenbach, MP for the DA, making this point that the DA, are driving forward legislation that would bring Scorpions 2.0, she calls it, back. And I think this bill will go through? No. Do I think it's a useful pressure tool? Most definitely. And if the GNU is nothing, if the GNU is not a panacea at all, but if it is nothing other than a recalibration of power to be more accountable in Parliament and vested in Parliament rather than around the cabinet table, I think it is a win. Not a spectacular one, but, you know, a win is a win. Michael, perhaps I could give you the final thought on this. What do you think other South Africans, ordinary or perhaps more celebrity like Chief Justice Zond, former Chief Justice Zond, can do about the issue of corruption, about pressurizing the change that would need to come for corruption, the tide of corruption to perhaps start turning?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, speaking out, making their opinions publicly ordinary, I think is a very important thing. If society begins to take it as given that we cannot live with corruption of the scale that Judge Zondo details in the piece, in his address today, how certain cases were examined, I think it's now 7 years ago, the details were delivered also before him at the Zondo Commission itself, and including his report, and there are still no arrests. So keep saying this is unacceptable. I think, you know, society does quietly judge things. We see it in our polling numbers. We see it in the election numbers. And society, the public opinion, will punish those who ignore it. We all now increasingly know that we cannot live with the scale of corruption that have been confronted with so far. There's just one small thing, extra thing I wanted to mention. You know, it often tends to be from the ANC this suggestion that corruption is this inconvenient happenstance that they're kind of dealing with on the side. But just to cite another aspect of it, our colleague Gabriel Krause recently wrote in Daily Maverick a piece pointing out the centrality to the kind of corrupt environment of policies like BEE. The Zondo Commission itself highlighted this. Gabriel's piece, I highly recommend people going to look at it. It was just not very many years ago, days ago, July the 9th. In the Daily Maverick, responding to a piece by Stephen Curtis, the headline, "Yes, Stephen, there is a direct link between BEE and state capture." That tells you all you need to know about the theme of it. He goes into a lot of detail. These are important things. So the policy environment is central to this greater problem that we're dealing with. We want more people like Judge Zondo to summon the courage and to confront the government with these hard truths.
I'm going to add a final word, and that is, I think you're so right. We often look at corruption as the disease, but it's actually a symptom. It is a symptom of government taxing too much, spending too much, and having too much prerogative, unchecked powers and discretion to spend it. And I have it here with me, I think. No, I don't. But there's a wonderful book about scandals and corruption in the Zuid-Afrikaanse Republiek under Paul Kruger. So corruption isn't an ANC thing. Kruger governments were racked with it quite often, but it always occurred when a government extracted more than it had to, spent more than it had to, and simply didn't have the oversight mechanisms that could force transparency and accountability. And perhaps that's why the Scorpion's idea lives on, is I think people understand that is the most visible part of how to turn it around, but it perhaps isn't the most notable in the long run. Well, for a short show, we have, I think, run a bit long. My apologies. Once Michael gets interesting, it is, I can only plead ignorance and naivety that once Michael gets talking, he becomes interesting inevitably. And once he becomes interesting, it is really difficult to stop him. So, Michael, I'm going to shamelessly blame you. But if you want to join us again as a listener, as a viewer, please follow, like, subscribe. You know the drill. And we'll see you in the next episode of the Daily Friend Show. God bless.
The Daily Friend Show and the Daily Friend are a project of the Institute of Race Relations, the IRR. The IRR is a think tank which was founded in 1929 to study race relations in South Africa and works to change government policy to improve race relations through non-racialism and to ensure the prosperity of all South Africans. If you like our work and would like to support us, please go to irr.org.za and click Support the IRR. Or you can go to thedailyfriend.co.za and click the Fund Us button.